and it is a tremendous pleasure to welcome Michael Ramsden.
Well, thank you for your introduction. My plan is hopefully to speak for 35 to 40 minutes and make some kind of sense. I only got a few hours sleep last night. I had one of those restless night sleeps you sometimes have when you're in a strange bed. And I woke up at 4:30 in the morning. And so, and this is now the third sort of thing that I'm involved with today. So there is the chance, not only that you may fall asleep in my own presentation, that I may do. As I was getting ready for this, I was reminded of a story, especially because we're in a cathedral tonight, of a Anglican bishop who was asked to speak on Radio 4 on Mother's Day. And he was very excited about this possibility, and this was a great chance for him. He'd never actually done something quite like that before, and here was the chance for a national address on Radio 4. The trouble was that he was speaking that afternoon, and by that morning, Sunday morning, he still didn't know what he was going to say. And he suddenly remembered that there was a very well-known church with a very well-known preacher who would speak there every Sunday morning. And he thought, you know, I may go and sit in the back on Sunday, see what this guy has to say. It may give me some ideas for this afternoon. So he snuck into the back of the church and without all of his bishop's garb on and just sat quietly. And this very well-known preacher came up to the front of the church at the end of the worship and looked out of the congregation, and his opening words were these. He said, "This morning, I found myself in the embrace of a woman who was not my wife." Well, you could hear an intake of breath from the whole group of people there who were thinking, what is this guy going to say next? And then he smiled and said, "It was my mother." And everybody was like, "Oh, that's great." And they applauded, and the bishop's in the back thinking, "That is brilliant. That is exactly what I will do when I speak this afternoon." Anyway, he'd also had a very bad night's sleep, so he gets back and he's drinking coffee and he's trying to now use this opening line to move into some other comments he can make while he's on Radio 4. And all of a sudden he looks at the time and realizes he's now running late, and so he just grabs his papers, he grabs his coat, he jumps in his car, he drives as fast as he can, he gets into the studio, they're anxiously waiting for him, they grab him, they shove him into the soundproof box, they close the door, and as he's reaching down to get his notes, the red light comes on air. And so he's desperately getting his notes and thinks, well, I'll just start with my opening line. And he said, "This morning, I found myself in the embrace of a woman who was not my wife." And then his mind just went blank. He was that tired. He realizes now that he grabbed the papers on his desk, but he didn't grab the notes that he'd been writing. So he's got nothing to refer to, and he just puts his head in his hands and leans forward into the microphone and says, "But for the life of me, I can't remember who it was." And so I'm rather worried about what misstep may happen here. So I will do my very best, and do bear with me if it just takes me a little time to tune into the questions that will come afterwards. What I'm going to try and do this evening with you is just look at three broad areas where people feel tough questions have been put to the Christian faith and it has failed. I'll just deal with them just very generally, and then allow you then to maybe add in, you know, some more detailed questions. And now if we have time, we might potentially do up to five, but I think we're going to do three because, A, I'm tired, and B, I want to make sure we have enough time to actually deal with the questions that you may want to come up. Now, the first area where a lot of people feel the Christian faith may have failed and have been unable to respond to questions are broadly of a philosophical nature. And those questions normally come in the form of, well, it's not true, or it's not even capable of being true. That's why you Christians have a faith. And faith is something which is largely psychological, that makes you feel good about some things, but isn't grounded in any particular way. I know when I first started doing what I'm doing, and as I started traveling around the world, I took particular note of questions that I got asked everywhere I went, or comments that people made everywhere I went. And one comment I used to hear fairly frequently was words to the effect of, "Michael, I'm so happy for you that you're a Christian, and I wish I could believe what you believe, but I can't." And I can remember after hearing that for the nth time, thinking, why are so many people saying this to me? And what I realized, what most people meant by that was, "Michael, you seem to be genuinely happy and fulfilled, and I am happy that you are happy." But the reason that you are so happy is because of your Christian faith. Now, by that they mean believing in something that isn't there. Now, what do we call people who believe in things that aren't there? Now, see, if you were more Pentecostal in nature at this point, would have audience participation. The answer is mad people. So what they're saying is, Michael, you are insane. But the main thing is that you are happy and insane. Now, I would love to be as happy as you seem to be, and I wish I could embrace insanity just to join you, and I've thought about it, and I even wish that I could. I just can't go there. Now, here we have to understand very clearly what is actually meant biblically by the word faith. For some people, faith is believing in things that you would like to believe in, but can't, but there's no evidence for it. It's not true. Strong faith, therefore, is being able to believe in things that you suspect aren't true, but you're able to believe them anyway. And on this scale, the strongest possible kind of faith you could have is when you know it isn't true, and you're still able to believe it. Because, I mean, how much faith does that take? Now, the Bible does say that faith is a gift, but it is not the gift of stupidity. It is not the gift that says you can believe in something that isn't there. In Hebrews 11:6, it says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. So if you want to please God, you need to have faith. So the next thing you want to know is, what is faith? And very handily, Hebrews 11:6 gives us a definition of faith. And faith is knowing that God is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now, that is saying two things. Firstly, it is a knowing of reality, knowing that something is, not wishing it is, or hoping it is, or thinking it is, or wouldn't it be nice it is, knowing that he is, and he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him, or trust him, or earn, well, the various ways of translating that. In other words, he is real, and he is true to his word. In that sense, we still use the word faith in this way in the English language today. So if I were to say to you, I was speaking at the Lord Mayor's prayer breakfast this morning, look, I have faith in the Lord Mayor. When I say that sentence, I have faith in him, you hear me saying two things. Number one, there is a real person who actually exists. Even if you didn't want him to exist, tough, he's still there. And two, I think that you can trust on his promises. Now, you may question my political judgment and think that I'm completely wrong. I don't know him that well. But when I say I have faith in him, nobody hears me saying, look, I want to postulate at a metaphysical level that I think there is an ontological entity I'm labeling the Lord Mayor, and I further have grounds to believe that this entity actually exists, and therefore I'm deserved in believing in him. No one hears me saying that, or if you do hear me saying that, then you're probably a graduate from a university with a philosophy degree, and you're taking it in a totally different way. That is not how the Bible uses the word faith. The word faith, it doesn't matter what translation of the scripture you read, whenever you see the word faith in the New Testament, it is always a translation of the word pistis, which is derived from the verb pito, to be persuaded, especially in a moral sense. It is being sure about someone that they are both real and that they are true. In that sense, biblical faith grows with understanding and with knowledge. I am not a Christian because I can answer every single difficult question you're about to ask me this evening. But it is a knowledge of a reality of a God who is both there, who is, and that he is trustworthy, that allows me to trust him even when I don't understand everything that is going on. So it's not the absence of something that increases my conviction. It is the presence of the knowledge of that reality, coupled with the fact that he is trustworthy, that strengthens faith. Which is why if you are a Christian here today and you have questions and you have a tendency to bury your questions, I would urge you not to. Because if you keep burying your questions, all of those unanswered questions will eventually undermine the ground you're standing on, and one day it will collapse. The way you grow in knowledge of truth and reality is by asking questions and probing into it until eventually you find understanding. Is that the kind of reality which you know in your own life? When you talk about having faith in God, if that's what you say you do have, is that what you mean, that you know him? And that you have that certainty of him. It is, the Bible never talks about faith as a sense of stepping, as a leap into the dark. It is always characterized as a stepping into the light. And when you step into the light, the beauty is that you can see and you're also seen. Now, I sometimes meet people who will say something to me, but Michael, I think I'm in the process of losing my faith. Now, that's a very honest question. Now, where we have to start with a question like that is, well, what do you mean by that? Because obviously, you can never lose something you never had. It's impossible to lose something you never had. So the question is it the case that you once knew the reality of God and that you knew his truth, and you feel that you're losing that? A presence in your life has gone. Or is it the case that you were raised up in a certain tradition or with a certain set of beliefs, and you're now questioning it and you're examining it and you're not sure if there's any good basis for it? In other words, are you just losing conviction about an idea or losing connection with a person? There is nothing to fear from asking difficult questions. We have to ask difficult questions. Jesus, did he exist? Did he claim to be God? Is there enough evidence for it? Those are all entirely legitimate questions, and they should and must be asked. Because anyone can stake a claim to anything. I don't know if you know the story of a psychiatrist who was transferred to a new wing of a psychiatric hospital, and the psychiatrist is now making the rounds, and he comes to the first bed, and he says to the guy, "Who are you?" And the guy says, "Oh, I am Napoleon." And the guy goes, "Well, that's interesting. Who told you you're Napoleon?" And he looks back at the doctor and he says, "Well, God told me." And the guy in the bed next to him said, "I did not." Anyone can stake a claim. The question is, can it be substantiated? Is there any evidence for it? Anyone can make that claim. The question is, what kind of evidence is there? I mean, one of the lines that Christians have always historically used about this is to do with prophecy. Because a prophecy isn't something that simply tells you what will happen before it happens. It tells you why it will happen before it happens. The interpretation is given before the event. So that when the event takes place, you don't have to sit around saying, "What does this mean?" You recognize a chain of events, the interpretation and significance of which has already been given. And it could be something that some of you would like to look into. But those philosophical questions are very, very, very important. And to some people, they will disturb you greatly. And to others, they'll seem largely unimportant. But they are important. And I'd encourage you to ask it. And if you don't, if you're not a Christian, by all means, look into it. Now, the second very broad group of questions are largely existentially driven. So these are born out of our experience, either of the church or what we feel is our experience of God. I once joked that the two biggest groups within this particular group are people who go to church and realize that they don't like their pastors, and pastors who've gone to church and eventually realize they didn't like the people. But it's actually much more complicated than that, and far more nuanced than that. If you feel disappointed with the church or with your experience of it, I would urge you to consider one thing. We're not sure which is the earliest book of the New Testament. The books of the New Testament as they were published aren't published in chronological order in here. They've been grouped. And there's like three books in the New Testament which are potentially the earliest Christian writings. And one of them is a letter to a group called the Galatians. Everyone agrees it was written by the Apostle Paul. Everyone agrees it was early, and potentially the earliest letter ever written to the church. Now, in it, one of the things Paul says is, what does it mean to be a Christian? And he says, look, if someone says they are a Christian, there should be a fruit in their life, fruit in the singular. And this fruit, he says, should have a particular taste. When you taste it, it should taste of love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, meekness, and self-control. Some of you may have memorized this if you went to church, Galatians 5:22. So what the Apostle Paul is saying to his critics is, bite me. But he's saying it in a very, very nice way. What he's saying is, when someone claims to be a Christian, taste the fruit in their life. And this is what it should taste of. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, and so on. He says, if what you taste is different, if what you taste is anger, bitterness, rage, malice, and so on, You have every right and maybe even the duty to question that fruit. Just because you claim to be something doesn't mean you are, the Apostle Paul is saying. Test it. What does it actually taste like? Now, this obviously has a huge challenge for the church. It's very interesting. If I were to say to you, I want you to close your eyes and imagine a thoroughly uncompromised Christian, an uncompromising Christian, what is the mental picture that comes to mind? Well, we know what the picture should come to mind. The thoroughly uncompromising Christian should be someone who is filled with love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness. So as Christians, let's not compromise on that. Let us be thoroughly uncompromising in terms of how we live out our faith. Now, there is another spiritual sense at times where we may ask this question, of course, about God himself. Where the sense of disappointment we have may not necessarily be with the church, but we feel it is with God directly. Now, this is a huge area. I can't go into all the nuances of it. For Paul, one of the things that he is very anxious to deal with is the philosophy of, I'm a good person, God, I'm doing my part, I'm trying as hard as I can, where are you? Now, there was a Latin motto in four words that summed up that whole philosophy. I am, which basically translates, God, I'm going to be good to you and help you, and you return the favor back to me. Now, I think a lot of us ask this question, and there are two painful and quite difficult things to say in response to it. First of all, biblically speaking, there is a complication with saying that we are good people. Someone once came to Jesus Christ and they asked him this question, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? They asked the question in Luke 18:18. Jesus replies with a question of his own. Why do you call me good, he says. Now, the logic behind the question is very simple. Jesus, you're obviously a good person. If anyone's going to go to heaven, it should be people like you. I want to go to heaven. What good thing should I do in order to go to heaven? So Jesus then says, asks his own question, why do you call me good? What makes someone good? Then he answers his own question. Only God is good. Okay, if you have to be good to go to heaven and only God is good, who is going? And the answer is no one apart from God. In other words, our application to join the Trinity has been refused. Minimum entry requirements are not met. Now, we all struggle with this idea that we are not, because we all love the idea that we are perfect people. And all I can say to you today is if you are sat here this evening and you honestly believe that you are perfect, the only way out of that state of self-deception is to get married. Now, the other side to this question, Paul also deals with in Galatians. The other side to I'm good. Paul in Galatians 1 says, look, there are two gospels. Except one isn't a gospel at all. He says there are two good newses, two gospels, but one is actually a curse. The gospel, which is no gospel at all, is the gospel that says, by good behavior, you can endear yourself to God and earn his favor. Paul is very strong. He says, cursed is the person who preaches this, and cursed is the person who lives it. If that is what you think and that's how you live, you will not live in a blessing before God. You will experience it as a curse. And he says it is no gospel at all. He says the gospel, which is the true gospel, the only good news, is that God himself has come into this world and gone to the cross and become a curse for us on the cross so that we don't have to. He has paid a price on our behalf that we cannot possibly pay. He has taken on all that is wrong. And he is dealing with it at the cross, and he is offering forgiveness. And if you ask him for it, he will give it to you, and you are forgiven. And it should be humbling. It should be inherently humbling. Let's supposing in the time of the Q&A that one of the leaders from this church asks me a question. And I look at them and I say, that is a stupid question. You have the intellectual capacity more commonly associated with forms of pond life which are invisible to the naked eye. It's Blackadder, in case you're wondering where it comes from. So let's supposing that's the question and that is my answer to the question. And for some strange reason, they feel it's insulting. Now, imagine the next morning you see me having coffee just before I head out to the airport. And you come up to me and you say, Michael, that was quite an interesting evening last night, interesting interaction with the church leader of the cathedral. How's your relationship with him? And I look at you and I say, you know what? He is the closest friend I have on this earth. There is no one I am closer to than this. Now, surely I would need to have the emotional intelligence of a carrot to say that, right? But let's supposing, having publicly insulted and humiliated this person, that after everyone had gone, they came up to me at the end and they said, Michael, how about we just have a quick cup of tea together? And we sit down, and over tea they say, I'm just trying to understand where all of that was coming from tonight. And as they talk to me and listen to me, it becomes abundantly clear that they're concerned for me, they love me, and they're willing to forgive me. And as we talk into the early hours of the morning, I break down in tears, and eventually I just say, you know, I am so sorry. I can't believe what I said. I can't believe I made up all those things about you. I was completely, totally, and utterly wrong. And they put their arm around with me, and they pray with me. And we keep talking until 6 o'clock in the morning. And now, here I am, having a cup of coffee to stay awake for my 7:30 a.m. pickup. And you come and you say to me, interesting evening last night, how's your relationship with that person? When I say to you, this is one of the people I feel closer to than anyone else in the world right now, I am speaking the absolute truth.